Welcome to episode 1488 of the 1010 Thrive podcast, brought to you by 1010 Thrive Ministries. 1010 Thrive, 10 minutes a day, based on 10 guidelines for abundant living. In the previous episode, Salome encountered her younger son in the pages of the gospel he had written. She recognized John immediately in its opening words. The boy who had always looked beneath the surface of things had become the man who began his account of Jesus before Abraham, before creation, in the beginning. The stories he chose to preserve, from Cana and Nicodemus to the Samaritan woman, Lazarus, and the washing of the disciples' feet, revealed the same mind Salome had watched developing since childhood. Patient, attentive, and unwilling to stop with what happened until he had wrestled with what it meant. Most of all, Salome recognized what had become of the Son of Thunder. John's intensity had not disappeared. It had been transformed into an understanding of love forged at the cross, the empty tomb, through years of caring for Mary, and through the loss of his brother James. The young man, who once wanted fire, called down upon a Samaritan village, became the apostle who insisted that God is love and that those who belong to him must love one another. His thunder had found its true voice, but Salome also understood something else as she read her son's words. John's life and calling would continue beyond hers. Acts of the Apostles, Part 6, Chapter 8.
I am going to tell you about the last time I saw my son. Not the last time we were in touch. We corresponded for a while afterward, the careful letters of two people who have said most of the important things in person and are now conducting the remaining business of love across a distance. I mean the last time I saw his face. The particular morning, I watched him walk away from me and understood without being told that I was watching the last walking away. He knew it too. John always knew things like that. The shape of moments, when something was completing itself. He held the goodbye in the way he held everything, fully and without flinching. And he looked at me the way he had looked at things since he was a child, as if he wanted to see it clearly enough to carry it with him forever. I did not weep. Not from stoicism. I have wept more than enough in my life, and I am not ashamed of any of it. But that morning, I had no tears. Only the long, clear outlook of a woman who has watched two sons become apostles and stood at a cross and knelt at an empty tomb and read the gospel her son wrote and now is watching him walk toward the rest of his life without her. I had things to say, and I said them, and then he went. I told him I was proud of him. I had not said this enough. Or perhaps I had said it in ways that were too ordinary for the weight of what I meant. So I said it plainly. I am proud of you. Not for the gospel, not for the ministry, not for the years of care for Mary. For the person you became. For the way the fire that was always in you found its direction. For the man who came back to the cross when everyone else ran. He started to say something. To deflect, I think. In the way he always deflected when someone tried to fix their attention on him rather than on what he was pointing toward. I stopped him. Let me say this. You have had your turn. You have written down what needs to be written. Let your mother say the last thing. He smiled. He has always had a smile that was slightly too quiet, as if it came from somewhere deep and did not want to draw attention to itself. He let me say the last thing. I told him that I understood now why Zebedee had let them go. That morning by the lake, when the nets were in his hands and the boats needed his sons, and he watched them walk away. I had never fully understood that until James died and John went to Ephesus, and I was left with the long understanding that some things a parent pours into a child are not for the parent. They are for the world. You do not raise a son for yourself. You raise him for whatever he was made for. You pour yourself into the vessel, and then the vessel goes where it is sent, and you stay. John looked at me for a long time when I said this.
You are in the gospel too, you know. You just don't see yourself there.
I told him I knew. I had read it. I recognized the woman at the cross in the distance, the one he does not name, the one who is simply there. I was there. That is enough. I want to say something about the women before I close this account. The record notes them without dwelling on them. Mark names us Mary Magdalene, and Mary the mother of James the younger and of Joses, and Salome. And we were looking on from afar. From afar, that is the phrase. at a distance, close enough to see, far enough to make the seeing its own kind of endurance. We were not inside the story in the way the 12 were inside it. We had not been called, named, commissioned, given a place in the formal structure of the movement. We had simply followed, the way women have always followed the things they love, from the edges, from the kitchens and the roads, from the place where mothers stand when the thing happening is too large to be held by any official role. And yet, when it mattered most, when the arrest came and the trials and the long terrible Friday, it was from the edges that the watching was done. It was the women who stayed. It was the women who came to the tomb. It was the women who were first. I am not claiming this as triumph. The watching was not easier because it came without a title. Standing at a distance while your son's teacher dies on a cross is not made more bearable by being unofficial. But I'm saying, the edge is not nothing. The place where mothers stand is not nowhere. What was witnessed there from afar was witnessed truly. And the witnesses endured. I endured. My legs held. My eyes stayed open. I watched. That is what I brought to the story. Not a title. Not a gospel. Not a letter. Or a vision. The willingness to stand at a distance and keep my eyes open and not look away from what was happening to the people I loved. It is not nothing. It is, in fact, everything that that place required. I knew my sons before Jesus did. I know that is not a theological statement. I know that the Gospel of John begins before the beginning, and that the Word was with God, and that nothing that exists came into existence apart from Him. I understand what that means, or I have come as close to understanding it as a woman from Bethsaida is likely to come in one lifetime. But I knew James before he learned to be impatient. I knew John before he learned to be still. I knew the fire before it had a direction, and I loved it without knowing what it was for, the way you love a child before they have become what they are going to be. The love that came before the knowing, the love that was not contingent on what they would do with their lives. That love is what I have been carrying through this entire account. Not admiration for what they became, though I have that too, abundantly, the prior love. The love that preceded everything and will outlast everything and was there on the morning by the lake when they were just my sons, in a boat not yet called. Jesus called them beloved. I called them James and John, and I called them to supper, and I called them to account when they came home with torn nets and improbable stories, and I called them by name in the dark when they were sick, and I called after them the morning they walked away from Zebedee and did not look back. I am their mother. That is what I know that no one else knows. Not the theology. Not the miracles. Not the significance of it all. The weight of them in my arms before they were anything. The specific, unrepeatable fact of them. James is gone. John is far away. Zebedee is gone. I am old. And the world has been made strange around me by what I have seen. And I would do it all again. Every morning. Every loss. Every hill. That is what mothers know. To be continued.
Much of Salome's story has taken place at the edges. She was not one of the 12. She did not preach at Pentecost, write a gospel, or lead the Jerusalem church. Yet she followed. She served. She remained at the cross when others fled. She walked toward the tomb while it was still dark. She sat beside a grieving son when words could not help, buried another, and eventually released the one who remained to a calling that would carry him beyond her reach. Her story reminds us that faithfulness is not measured by prominence. Sometimes the holiest thing we can do is remain present, keep our eyes open, and love faithfully from the place God has given us. There is also something profoundly revealing in Salome's description of loving James and John before they had accomplished anything, before they were apostles, martyrs, evangelists, or sons of thunder. They were simply her children. Her love did not begin when their lives became significant. It preceded achievement, failure, calling, and transformation. In that maternal love, we can glimpse something even greater about the love of God. We do not become worthy of His love by becoming useful to Him. His love comes first. Everything we become in His hands begins there. Perhaps that is what finally allowed Salome to release her sons. If love is possession, letting go is only loss. But if love desires that another become everything God created them to be, then sometimes love must open its hands. Salome opened hers to James and John, just as Zebedee had opened his beside the Sea of Galilee. Faith does not promise that loving deeply will spare us grief. It teaches us that love is worth the grief, that faithfulness is worth the cost, and that because the tomb was empty, even our final goodbyes are not truly final. To be continued.